Well, good afternoon. I hope you're doing well this afternoon, and we're grateful for the presence of all, as Pat said, especially those who are visiting with us. To begin our lesson tonight, I'm going to summarize a story from the Bible, and you have to tell me what story I'm telling. Does that sound good? Here is the summary of what this story is. And if you were in our Bible class this morning, you got a little preview of this, but for everybody else, perhaps this is something you're seeing for the first time. What story does this sound like? Oh, Eric messed it up. Okay, there we go. Two messengers from God enter a city about to be destroyed. Oh, it's still not working. Help, help. Probably not on. No. All right, let's try it again. Two messengers, which is a very specific word in Hebrew, from God enter a city about to be destroyed. The city is located in the lower plain of the Jordan, and it is a prosperous city, but very wicked. The two messengers enter the house of a God-fearing but sinful host. Local men demand that the host bring out the men who came to you tonight. And both men find protection due to the roof of their host. That word is mentioned specifically. The host seeks to divert and distract those who seek to harm the guests and is even a little bit sinful, probably, in the way they go about doing this. The host speaks to them before they lay down that evening, and there is a command to flee to the hills or else something really bad is going to happen if you don't do that. And as the city is destroyed by fire, this host is saved, though the rest of the city is destroyed. Okay, you're good Bible students. What account, what story from the Old Testament does this sound like? Well, it sounds like Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah. And you're exactly right, Lot and the destruction of Sodom. I've got some references up there from Genesis chapter 19 that shows this is the vocabulary that's used, these words that are in quotations. This is the basic structure of that story. But as we were reading this week from the beginning of Joshua, it also sounds like another story from our Bible reading this week with Rahab and the destruction of Jericho. Again, two messengers from God enter a city about to be destroyed. The city is located in the same place there in the plain of the Jordan. These two messengers enter the house of a God-fearing but sinful host, Rahab. Local men demand that the host, Rahab, bring out the men who came to you tonight. But these men find protection due to the roof of her house as they hide there on the roof under the stalks. The host, Rahab, seeks to divert and distract those who seek to harm the guest, and she clearly lies in doing so. The host speaks to them before they lay down that evening, and there is a command for them to flee to the hills or else they may be destroyed. And as this city is destroyed by fire in Joshua chapter 6, the host, Rahab, and her family are saved. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Let's read the account of Rahab and the spies in Joshua chapter 2 together. And what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and read this whole account, beginning in verse 1. We will read down through verse 21, and then we'll read just a few verses in chapter 6. We're going to do all this reading on the front end. I want you to see this connection between these two passages for yourself, and then we will make some applications to two very important things as we look at these two accounts and what the author and the Holy Spirit is trying to do for us. So let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 2 of the book of Joshua. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, sent out two men from Achaia Grove to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went. They came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I do not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut, when it was dark, that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. But she, verse 6, had brought them up on the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid on order in the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof. And she said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. So the men answered her, our lives for yours. If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, get to the mountain, or the hills, depending on your translations, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterward, you may go your way. So the men said to her, we will be blameless of this oath of yours, which you have made us swear, unless, when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household into your own house. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we will be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath which you made us swear. Then she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. Just a note there, I find it interesting. When did she bind the scarlet cord? As they were leaving. She didn't wait for them to start marching around the walls. She went ahead and took care of that. Now, we're familiar with the account of Jericho in chapter 6, but at the end of that account, when God has given the city into their hand, the walls, presumably all the other walls, except for where her house was, fell down flat, which, again, I think is a pretty cool picture of God's working here. All the other walls are down except for this one place with this one house in the wall. Notice what happens in verse 22 of chapter 6. But Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the country, go into the harlot's house. And from there bring out the woman and all that she has as you swore to her. And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and irons they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now, it certainly seems clear just by this list that there is a connection between these two texts. Grammatically, we have an even greater connection. There are a number of phrases that only appear in the Hebrew Bible in these two texts. So the phrases came, or the words came to you and tonight, those words only appear together in these two texts. The specific phrase, before they lay down, only appears in these two texts. And so what it seems to me is happening here is, as we so often see in the Bible, the one who is writing by the Holy Spirit, the book of Joshua, is wanting us to think back to this other text in Genesis chapter 19 with Lot and the destruction of Sodom. And that connection is being made along with some very important contrasts so that we might understand and see some important lessons and points about two things. I believe that this connection between these two texts gives us some lessons on God and some lessons on faith. Some very important applications on God and who He is and what He is doing, and then some very important lessons and applications on faith and what true faith really looks like. Now, our general way of considering connections like this is that commonality shows connection. So those things that are so clearly in common says that these two texts go together. And usually the contrast, especially those things that are exactly opposite, show us the point that is being made. But in this case, I would suggest that there are some important points being made and lessons to be learned from the commonality of these texts. And the commonality gives us the lessons about God, and the contrasts give us the lessons about faith. So as we think about these lessons about God and the commonality between these two texts, this comes, Joshua chapter 2, this account comes at the beginning of a very violent, very bloody, very uncomfortable book, especially for us as New Testament Christians. And I believe having this account where it appears here in the second chapter clears up some things for us about God, who He is, His nature, and how He is working in the book of Joshua, which hopefully will be helpful to us, not just now in thinking about who God is, but as we continue to read through this book in seeing the way God is working in destroying the people of the land. Now, it is clear just logically as we look through and read through the book of Joshua that there is some hyperbole in the way God's destruction in Joshua is described. We see descriptions of a city where every single thing is destroyed, and then later on in the same text, we see that there's still people there. So there is some hyperbole being used here. But that can't explain everything that's happening. Even with some hyperbole, we cannot minimize the reality that what's taking place in Joshua is a holy war with mass casualties. So how do we reconcile that with the God that we know? Well, Rahab's story specifically shows us some things about God and what's going to happen in the rest of this book. And the first point that we need to see is that God is just. That God is just in His working in this book, and of course in His working throughout all history. The question that begs to be asked is why? Why was God having the Israelites destroy and drive out the people of the land of Canaan? Well, the connection that we make from Joshua chapter 2 to Genesis chapter 19 gives us the good reason why. It is because the people of this land were just like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. They were a sinful and unrighteous people who needed to be destroyed for the sake of God's earth. God wants us to remember Sodom and Gomorrah and equate their wickedness, you know, these cities that are put on this pedestal as the most wicked cities in all the Bible. He wants us to equate their wickedness with the wickedness of this people in this same land, Jericho, in a very similar sort of place as Sodom and Gomorrah. If you go back to Genesis chapter 15, remember that God makes promises to Abraham in 12 and 15 and 18. And He promises Abraham that He is going to give him the land in which he is dwelling, the land of Canaan. And God is powerful enough that he could have given that land to Abraham right then and there. I mean, he could have snapped his finger and the land would have been clear of all people and Abraham's descendants could have just grown up in the land. Now, that wouldn't have accomplished God's purposes and them going to Egypt and bringing them out of Egypt in the Exodus and everything that goes with that. But it also was not the right time to do that in terms of what was happening in the land itself and who these people were. If you're there in Genesis chapter 15, begin reading with me in verse 13. Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. So that describes their time in Egypt as slaves. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." Well, that's exactly what happens in the Exodus. They come out and they are given all of these gifts from the Egyptians. They're a great nation with great possessions, and God brings them out as he judges all of the gods of Egypt. "Now, as for you," verse 15, "you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age, but in the fourth generation..." Now, these aren't modern generations or even generations like we see later in the Bible. These are patriarchal, Abraham-type generations. So we think 100 years for a generation, that's the way he's equating time. Just as he said earlier, 400 years from now, they, the descendants of Abraham, shall return here. Why is God going to wait 400 years? For, this is the reason why, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete or full. What God says is, this people, the Amorites, which is a fill-in for all of the Canaanites, this people, is not, they are not wicked enough yet for me to totally drive them out of this land to give it to your descendants. But we get to Joshua chapter 2, and the iniquity, the evil of the people of the land is now full, and they needed to be judged for that wickedness. Judgment and justice came as a result of the nations practicing such sordid and terrible evil that there was no hope left, even for their children, even for their future. They had become totally evil in their deeds. And Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 27 speaks about it in moral terms and ceremonial terms. The land itself, the land of Canaan, had become unclean because of all of the detestable things that the people were doing, because of the abominations committed by the nations. And it needed to be cleansed, purged, made clean again by God himself. Moses says specifically in Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 4 and again in verse 5 and a few other places in that context, it is not because of, you know, the people of Israel were so good and so righteous that God was giving them this land. No, it was because of the wickedness of these nations that God is dispossessing them of the land before his people. Because of their wickedness, God wanted these nations gone, so that his people would avoid the same kind of wickedness that they were committing. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. We'll read verses 29 through 31. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 29. It's interesting, earlier in this same chapter, we see that phrase for the first time of every man doing what is right in his own eyes. Sadly, that's going to be the people of God in the book of Judges, but that was the way the people, the Amorites and Canaanites in the land, were acting at this time. In verse 29, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise.' You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord, which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it, and you shall not add to it nor take away from it. There are many abominations that were being committed by the people. And one of the evil practices of these nations was burning their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. These nations were practicing human sacrifice, taking life and death matters into their own hands. And one must not think that these were just some innocent, you know, poor people minding their own business and God just comes in and destroys them. They were wicked to the core. And God was exercising his right to bring full judgment on them. Justice, true justice, justice that comes from a just God is in God's hands. And to deny him of his justice is to think somehow that mercy toward unrepentant evil is more important than righteous judgment on those who turn their back on God. And if that becomes our framework for understanding events, it starts us down a road where God's holiness and God's glory become meaningless to us. God is a good and merciful God, but he is also a just God. And his justice is seen because these people had become like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. But what happened before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah? Do you remember? Those two men first met with Abraham before they went into the city and met with Lot, and all those events took place. And God says, am I going to really hide this from Abraham, what I'm about to do? And so he reveals to Abraham that Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed. Turn to Genesis chapter 18. We remember what Abraham does in response in Genesis chapter 18. He starts, we might say, bargaining with God. He asks the question, will you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? And he says, you know, suppose there are 50 righteous souls in this city. Will you spare the city for 50 righteous souls? And God says, yes, I will spare it for 50. And Abraham, he keeps going down and down and down and down. And finally, in verse 32, he asks for the last time, the last number. Then he said, let not the Lord be angry. I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Even for the sake of 10 righteous souls, God would have spared Sodom and Gomorrah. Which brings us to the second point Rahab and her connection to Lot is making. God is just, but God is also merciful. God is still willing to spare those who turn to him in faith, even among the people of this land that the Israelites were coming to destroy. He is still patient and long-suffering, and even in this we see his justice, that he will not destroy the righteous with the wicked. God saw this woman's faith, and he worked providentially to bring about circumstances where she might be spared because of her faith. Despite her shortcomings, despite her sin, on the basis of her faith, God spared her. And others in the land could have, and we see a few other examples where people did have the same result of being spared by God, despite his decree of destroying the people in the land, because they turned to God so that they might live. So the commonalities between these two texts shows us that God is just in doing what he's doing in the book of Joshua, but he is also merciful toward people like Rahab, who are people of faith that come to him. And that brings us to the differences between these two texts. Yes, there are a lot of similarities between Lot and Rahab, but what are the differences between specifically Lot himself and Rahab and the way they act in these two texts? Well, there's a lot of things that no doubt you would come up with, but let me suggest these things this evening. Lot had a long personal history with the God of Abraham. He had been with Abraham through all of this time. He had seen the blessings on God by God on Abraham, and he was a beneficiary of many of those blessings. And so Lot understood who the true God was. Rahab had only heard of his works. She didn't have some long history with Yahweh, and yet she recognized that he was God of heaven and earth. Another contrast is that Lot, who was a father, sacrificed his daughters and ended up losing his family because of his compromise with wickedness in Sodom and Gomorrah. And Rahab is just the opposite. Rahab is a daughter who pleaded for her father, and ultimately her father and all of her family were saved because of her efforts in pleading with the God of Israel. Another contrast is that Lot delayed his obedience. Multiple times in the text in Genesis chapter 19, Lot is delaying for no good reason. It's almost as if the angels finally have to shake him and say, get out of here, man. We got to destroy this city. And yet, what do we see with Rahab? Rahab obeyed right away. They said put a scarlet cord in the window before we come back. She puts it in the window right away. They put conditions on making sure that you got to do all of these things if you want to be saved, and she does every single one of them. She obeyed right away, and she obeyed exactly as was commanded. Lot, on the other hand, he negotiates his obedience. He talks about his sons-in-law and talks with them. He delays, and then when he's told to flee to the hills, do you remember what he says? What about this little city over here? It's just a little city. Can I go there instead? And though God relents, it is clear that Lot has a different kind of heart than Rahab. And that's what we see. At the beginning of the account, Lot appears righteous, doesn't he? I mean, he is the hero of the story for the first number of verses. He saves these men out of the open square. He brings them into his own home and shows hospitality and care toward them. When the men of the city come against them, he steps outside, and he is this barrier between these men and his guests from God. And it's like, yeah, Lot is this righteous man. And he is righteous. The New Testament calls him a righteous man and how all of this wickedness vexed his righteous soul. But he reveals that he still has sin in his heart, doesn't he? Because he offers up his daughters to these men who are coming against his door. Rahab is exactly the opposite. From the very beginning, Rahab appears sinful, and she is. She is a harlot, and that is the appropriate designation for the business that she was practicing. She lies, and there's no way of getting around the fact that she lies in what she's doing and trying to protect the spies. And so we see this woman who is sinful, and there's no arguing that she is sinful in the things that she was doing. But ultimately, her faith reveals her righteous heart, that she had a heart that wanted to do what was right and believed in the God of Israel. They are just the opposites. And then finally, Lot's story ends with a shameful lineage where he has children by his own daughters, and there are dire consequences for the people of God, including some of the very people they're going to dispossess from the land, some of these very descendants that they're going to have battles with in the chapters to come in the book of Joshua. Rahab's story? Well, we read there in Joshua chapter 6 how she dwelt with those people until that day whenever the book of Joshua was written. And we learn later that she is going to be in the lineage of David and finally in the lineage of Jesus as well. So the story ends with shame and honor being perhaps the opposite of what we would expect. So what does this contrast show us? Well, I suggest that this contrast between these two stories and the way that Rahab behaves herself, especially in contrast to Lot, gives us some lessons about faith and what true, genuine faith looks like. So what do we see about the faith of Rahab that can inform our own? How do we see how God used her with her faith despite her obvious shortcomings? Well, I would suggest these things about Rahab's faith. Number one, Rahab's faith was simple. You know, Lot's faith is complicated, isn't it? It's always, bothered me. I'd say it's bothered me that he is called in the New Testament a righteous man. When I read the text, it does not appear that he is a righteous man. And yet, there was this idea of these things bothered him. It was wrong, and he knew it was wrong, and he was trying to have an influence on that sinful community by his presence there. And so there is this complicated nature to Lot in terms of his faith. He's called righteous, but then he makes all of these compromises, all these sorts of things. Rahab's faith was simple. I have heard, I believe, and now I will obey whatever it is God tells me to do. I was having a text conversation with a good friend of mine, and we were talking about the song, Trust and Obey. And he said, if I never hear that song again, it'll be too soon. Well, I don't know what your feelings are toward that song. I personally love that song. I think the words are really good. Maybe part of the reason why is it was kind of a lullaby we used to sing to Madison. Maybe that's why it has partly a special place in my heart. But there is a certain amount of simplicity in that song. And this guy I was texting with, he says, well, I just don't like it. There's no depth to it. Well, trust and obey. That's simple, isn't it? But doesn't that sum up what we're supposed to do? And that's exactly what Rahab does. Her past is complicated. Where she's coming from is complicated, but her faith is not. She trusts that God is who he has proven himself to be, and she will obey whatever it is the messengers from God tell her to do so that she might be right with him. May all of us, as God is our witness, may all of us have simple faith like that. Isn't this exactly what Jesus demands of us? Turn quickly to Matthew chapter 19, if you would. Matthew chapter 19. In Matthew chapter 19, there is a complicated text beginning in verse 1 with all of these questions about marriage. And why did Moses permit certain things with marriage and not? And Jesus tries to simplify it by going back to the beginning in the book of Genesis. But this complicated text is because of questions that the Pharisees, dishonest questions the Pharisees had of him. And it's in that context that he says what he does in verse 13. Then the little children were brought to him that he might put his hands on them and pray, but the disciples rebuked them. But Jesus said, let the little children come to me, and do not forsake them, for such is the kingdom of heaven. And he laid his hands on them and departed from there. For such is the kingdom of heaven. If we want to be pleasing to God, we need to make our faith like a little child. Trust and obey. Rahab's faith was simple in contrast to Lot's faith. Secondly, Rahab's faith was selfless. Her faith was primarily to serve others and to save others. If you go back to the book of Joshua in verses 12 and 13 there in the second chapter, I want you to read again exactly what it is that she says in terms of what she wants, what she desires from these two men that are from God. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 12. Now, therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness to me and save my life. No. That you will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have and deliver our lives from death. Rahab sneaks her own life in there right there at the end. But everything before that is about others and what others need and how she might be of service to others in ways, clearly, that they don't even know about yet. That's the kind of faith that she had. And again, it's contrasted with Lot's faith. He makes a half-hearted effort to try and save his son-in-laws, but to them, it seemed like he was joking about the things that he was doing. What he needed to do was exactly what the angels did to him. Shake and say, this is serious. This is something important. And if you want to be saved, you're going to have to do what these men say. Instead, it seems as though Lot was concerned about himself. Don't send me to the boondocks. Don't send me to the hills. Send me to this little city instead, because, well, that's who he'd become. May we have faith like Rahab that's selfless, that seeks to serve others, that seeks to put the needs of others before our own. And in that way, we are not just imitating her, we're imitating Jesus Christ as well. Number three, Rahab's faith was not by sight. Now, it wasn't blind. It was reasoned. But she hadn't personally seen any of these things. It's interesting the words that she uses. In verse 9, she says, I know that the Lord has given you the land. Why? Verse 10, for we have heard how the Lord has done these things. Well, isn't that exactly the kind of faith that we are supposed to have? We hear the message that is proclaimed to us from God's word. And based on that, we are to know. We are to believe. We are to trust that what God has said is true. She trusted that God would fulfill his promises to her. And because of that trust, she acted in such a way to receive those promises from God. And then finally, number four, Rahab's faith was submissive. She acted. She obeyed by faith. One of the things that I really enjoy about this contrast between these two accounts is that Rahab has, in contrast with Lot, what I believe to be are the three hallmarks of truly biblical obedient faith. Did you catch this? I've highlighted them for you. Rahab obeyed right away. How many times in the scriptures have people gone wrong in their faithful obedience because they waited? Because they didn't do what God said right when he said they needed to do it. She obeyed right away. Rahab did exactly as she was commanded. She didn't try and negotiate with these men. She didn't try and negotiate with God. She did exactly as she was commanded, and she did it right away. And then finally, the third hallmark is that Rahab did it with a good heart. Rahab, yes, she is sinful at the beginning of the story, but she reveals her righteous heart, that her faith comes from a heart that is good and honest, that wants to do right. And that is why this woman is remembered the way she's remembered in the New Testament. Read these two verses from the New Testament with me. These will be the last two verses that we'll read tonight, and then the lesson will be yours. Turn to James chapter 2. James chapter 2. In emphasizing that faith without works is dead, James uses Abraham as an example, and then he uses Rahab as an example. You see then, verse 24, that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. If you go back to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31, in this great list of witnesses who did things by faith, we find Rahab mentioned in chapter 11 and verse 31. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she received the spies with peace. She obeyed. She acted based on the faith that she had. And I think part of her action that should be emphasized to us is that she acted, she did these things in such a way that she did not allow her past, she did not allow her present circumstances to get in the way of her future faith. It's interesting to me how people use this passage to justify all sorts of things, lying under various circumstances. That totally misses the point. Rahab was sinful in the things that she does. That's a fact of the account. But she is praised in Hebrews 11 for receiving the spies in peace, not lying, nor being a harlot. She is praised for her faith and acceptance of the God of heaven and earth. She is praised for the part that she played in God's plan, and she is spared from destruction because of it. God commends her faith, a faith that grew out of circumstances that had very few advantages. Nothing like Lot and all of the advantages that he had. The nephew of Abraham traveling with the patriarch of promise. And yet this woman in this sinful city She did what God called her to do when the moment came. And while she is not mentioned by name again in the Old Testament, we do know something of what she did. She continued to dwell with the people of God. She raised a faithful family, and David and Jesus came from her. Rahab's faith was simple and selfless, and not by sight and submissive. Is our faith the same? Does this describe your faith? Will I be a Lot, or will I be a Rahab? And I hope now we are better equipped to know and see what that answer should be for every one of us. And if you're here this evening and you're not yet a Christian, I pray that you have the simple faith of Rahab, the kind of selfless faith that says, I will believe and obey, and I will do so on the basis of what God has called me to do. And if you're willing to submit to God even this evening, we'll put everything that we can into helping you. We'll pray for you. We'll pray with you. If you need the waters, the cleansing waters of baptism, we'll baptize you in the name of Jesus Christ so that you might rise to walk in newness of life. If we can help you in any way this evening, won't you come now while together we stand and while we sing.